Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 75 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that has a little bit for everyone and a lot of shenanigans. I'm Aaron Paulette, and with me, as always, is my lovely, my loquacious, my ludicrous host, Weird Beard. How are you doing, Weird?
You just took the keys away from me. And I love it. Yeah, for those who listen to the ACP blooper reel, yeah, you're going to hear that those shenanigans. I think it's going to be a long one. Never have trouble getting content for the blooper reel. Never have trouble. I'm doing good, Aaron. I'm having fun. I'm recording a podcast. I'm in my happy place. So anything new with you?
Yes. Let's see. Since last we spoke, I gave a presentation for the Libertarian Party of Orange County. Mm-hmm. And that would be Florida, by the way, not Orange County, California, or I think there's an Orange County, Texas.
There's a bunch of Orange counties. There really are.
But I gave a great presentation. I know that I'm doing well when I run out of time and the leader says, no, go on. You've got all the time you need. Okay. And I'm going to upload a video of that very soon, provide a link, do something like that so that people can watch it. The video quality isn't the best. And the reason for that is because it was being live streamed over restaurant Wi-Fi. And so that's not the best bandwidth. And so it compressed it and did other things. But the important point is that you get to see me and hear me. So there's that. Hooray. Yeah. The other thing, and this is going to be a while, but in about 3 weeks, I'm going to be up in Arlington, Virginia, because I have been invited to give a speech. And this group is, I think it's the Declaration of Restoration, and they're going to present some grievances to the government, and I've been asked to speak on behalf of the Second Amendment, and so I'm going to be doing that. And for people who consume what I produce, it's probably not going to be anything new, because I've got a set amount of material. And especially if I'm given a short amount of time, like 10 minutes. And so, like a lot of performers, I polish my stuff until it gleams. And once I've got something that works, I use it. Which is why I'm actually fairly good with extemporaneous things like interviews. It's because I've done them enough times that I just go, oh, this is conversation 3A. And I can just pull that out. It's not like you have to show up. I'm going to do something new. It's probably going to be very close to what I did for the rally and tally. But it's cool that I've been invited, and I'm going to get to spread my message to other people that haven't heard of me before. So anything that gets the word out, especially to people who might not agree with me, that is something that is worth spending the travel money on. Plus, I get to meet some friends in Virginia because I lived up there for 5 years, and so it's always neat to go up and see them.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, and there's certainly something to be said about essentially your an elevator speech, so to speak, on the, you've got your standard talking points of the, look, I get it. On the Assorted Calibers podcast, we got to keep it fresh because we got to assume mm-hmm. that people are either have been listening, or I'm hopefully thinking, if you're new to this show, that you're going to be like, you know what? This show's pretty decent. Maybe I should listen to a few more, previous ones and go and start going backwards when I've got a spare moment. And so you got to keep it fresh. You don't want to just keep repeating the same stuff with that. But at the same time, when I go on to other podcasts, I've got to assume that they have never heard me on any of my other endeavors ever before. So you go back to the solid ground and you lay down the key points, because when you got a new audience, you can't assume that they already heard everything that you've said before.
Exactly. And the number one question I'm asked is, so what's Operation Blazing Sword, and how did it come about, and what do you do? Okay. And so it's not that I'm upset at being asked the question. It's more like, well, I don't want to sound like a jerk, but it's one of those, okay, here we go again. Mm-hmm. And I launch into my spiel, and I don't know how to describe it, but just because I'm a creative person, I dislike saying the same things over and over. I know that it's necessary, and I do it, and I try to mix it up a little bit, but it's basically the same thing, which is why it's really cool when I get to be asked some unexpected questions. And so we were talking about this before the show. I was asked by someone from a policy group up in Washington, D.C., about my thoughts on guns and gun control and whatever. And they actually asked me some questions I'd never been asked before. Like, you know, if you had $1 billion, what would you do to change policy about guns? And it's like, wow, cool. I've got to give this some thought.
Yeah, that is a cool question.
I mean, you know, right off the top of my head, it would be, okay, so $1 million is immediately going to go to OBS for operating purposes. I'm going to shave off $1 million just for my salary for the next 20 years or something, because I can live very cheaply, and that way I don't have to worry about such things.
You could turn it into an endowment.
Possibly. I mean, the ones that came to my mind was, okay, I'm going to get a financial advisor, and I'm going to put, like, I don't know, 800, no, split it apart. So, like, $400 million is going to go into, like, a bank account with a high interest return so that, you know, hopefully we could live off the interest. And then, like, the other $400 million, you know, I'd invest in blue chips or something like that. The idea being, I'm in this for the long haul, and I'm going to have to counter Bloomberg and his billions. So if I have $1 billion, I'm going to turn that into seed money. And okay, we're digging in, and I'm looking at long-term returns. And hopefully, you know, if things work out, we could live on the interest and get, like, you know, $1 million a year. And a budget of $1 million a year is just, oh my God, I can't conceive of that. Yeah. That would be really, really cool. So that's just one of the questions that I've never been asked until now, and that's awesome.
Yeah, that's one of those interesting things, is that, you know, people talk so much about the NRA and their money, but let's be honest, especially with all the current problems with the NRA, that's starting to become quite a hollow point that they're starting to make. I don't know if they're aware, they're just being dishonest when they're vilifying the NRA in such a way that they're doing it. Because, yeah, I really don't see it as the asset that it used to be. And maybe it wasn't always that asset. But one of the things is that Bloomberg just throws so much money. He doesn't necessarily equal the NRA in some of its spending budgets, because the NRA is in all 50 states and all over the place. And it's one of those, like, even if you spread it out fairly thin, that adds up to real money real quick. And, but Bloomberg is very, very targeted with what he does. He'll pick, like, I mean, pick the state of Maine and just literally went through and bought all the ad space. But he bought all the ad space and he lost. He bought the ad space. He bought the referendum. He bought everything that you can throw money at. But there are certain things that you can't buy. People talk about buying votes, but it doesn't work that way, because people keep trying to do it and they fail. And so there is that on the, you know, Bloomberg outspent the NRA and the pro-gun groups in Maine, like something like 10 to 1. And yet the Second Amendment still prevailed in Maine, and it outspent the people of Nevada, and it went down by like something like a 1,000 votes, or was it even 100 votes? It was like a pittance of a number. And then also it turned out, oh, we wrote this in New York for that in ways that don't apply to Nevada. So it got shot down and nobody cared. Everyone just went, ooh, we dodged a bullet with that one. That was a crappy law.
I mean, I'm always happy when Bloomberg loses money, especially when he's able to inject it into the economy. But the problem is that okay, he lost this money, but he didn't really feel it. I mean, I'm sure somewhere he went, oh, that's too bad. But it's not like it dealt him a stunning blow. It was just, okay, that was a line item in my budget.
Yeah, I think his money is the exact same as the money that I bring into a casino. I'm not much of a gambler, but essentially I always operate that if I'm going to go sit at a blackjack table or play some video poker, which are my two favorite things to do if I'm going to gamble, which is really, it's not a lot of fun. I'd much rather play video games. But if I'm going to do that, I might say, all right, how much am I paying to be entertained? Is this worth $20, $50, $100? And I see it as the same way as the going to see a stand-up comedian or going to a theatrical performance. Is the you'd pay $60 to go, you know, see a theatrical performance. I had spent, you know, over, you know, I don't even know how much the tickets were. My wife ended up picking up, but I'm pretty sure it was a few $100 to go see Bill Burr at the Boston Garden, which was awesome. And it's one of those, it was well worth it. You know, so sometimes it's one of those like, yeah, to sit at a blackjack table with a real croupier, with some other people that are gambling around you. How much is that experience worth? And I think Bloomberg's putting on that. I think it's one of those, the money's gone no matter what, because it's not like he's going to get a monetary return on his investment. So, yeah, it's not hurting him. But at the same time, the point that I'm getting at is that all being said, the Second Amendment really doesn't have it. We don't have our billionaire. And I just imagine if we did.
I know. That's something I've said before, and I've said it not really farcically, but I never think it'll happen, but I would love to be the anti-Bloomberg.
Yeah, to have what we have, the boots on the ground and all of that, though maybe at the same time, I think some of the issues we're having with the NRA is that sometimes by having a strong force in our, you know, a powerful hold card, we sometimes get complacent. I mean, it's one of those, we managed to hold the line pretty good under the Obama administration that was directly hostile to the Second Amendment. And then when Donald Trump edges up to the NRA and is like, I'm there and I'm supporting you, I'm giving speeches in front of the NRA, the NRA annual meeting and all that. And then we get the bump stock bans, and he's talking about banning suppressors and all sorts of other goofy stuff. So
speaking of goofy stuff, there's actually a case in California that I've read the article twice. Mm-hmm. I understand all the words. It still boggles me. And so for the benefit of our listeners, wink, I'm going to be asking a lot of dumb questions. And Weird, you can play the role of the wise scholar who educates me. You will be Batman to my Robin in this case.
Yeah, well, so I'm going off of a CNN article, and of course that's in the show notes. But this is a story out of California, and the headline is, he sold illegal AR-15s, feds agreed to let him go to avoid hurting gun control efforts. My reading of this is, I think that's either a disingenuous title or the person who wrote this totally just missed the point of everything, because that's just not how I read it.
But the thing is, it's actually a very salacious title, and it doesn't make the federal government look good. Mm-mm. You know, feds agree to let a criminal go in order to keep, you know, oppressing people. Of course, that's how I read it. I'm sure that people on the far anti-rights spectrum will see it differently.
Yeah.
So why don't you hit the high points so that I can then express my confusion here?
Yeah, well, and there's some stuff. I mean, I need to dial a little bit more. This is California law, and so I might be missing some, some finer points on it. Like maybe that these guns don't have the appointments, but the opening line, for more than a year, Joseph Rowe illegally manufactured AR-15 style rifles in a warehouse south of Los Angeles.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. But as you go reading down, this is a guy who essentially was helping people build rifles from 80% lowers, build and assemble rifles from 80% lowers. He was essentially holding build parties and things like that. And he had a bunch of, the word loophole gets thrown around a lot in this, but he definitely was exploiting some loopholes. Like there was a point where it said like he was requiring people that were using his facility to be members of the club. And so
and they had to pay a $25 fee so that they joined the club, which means he wasn't making it available to the general public. I'm not really sure why that matters. About manufacturing weapons, I think, ATF, blah, blah, blah.
I don't know if it got struck down, but I know for a fact that when Maine passed their smoking ban for restaurants, which was, I think, in the late 90s, I do know a few restaurants that had a lot of smoking customers essentially changed their business model around where it was still the exact same place, but it was no longer a public restaurant. It was a private club, and private clubs had a different latitude. We're not considered all that. I mean, it's one of those like the, mm-hmm. if you're a member of a social club, they could serve food and they could do all that. And essentially it was you needed to become a member, and they just simply pulled up a member book. They bought a notebook and charged people mm-hmm. $1 for a lifetime membership to their restaurant. And so if you showed up and it was your first time eating there, you'd have to break a single off your wallet and put it, you know, give it to the maitre d' before they would seat you. And mm-hmm. then since it was now a private club and not a restaurant, you could also enjoy a cigarette with your meal if you so wanted.
So in Joseph Rowe's case, he has a machine shop. He had at least one CNC mill, and he or an employee or maybe the person purchasing it would put the 80% lower into a jig. And the important point is that the customer would push the green button to start the program. And therefore, that would mean the customer is manufacturing the firearm and not Joseph Rowe and his company. The thing is, though, 80% lowers are legal. It's legal to manufacture them. So how is it he sold illegal AR-15s, according to the title?
Well, and then the bottom line is the feds let him go. I think that's the operative point. I think it's being glossed over, is that there's definitely some talk that I think it's stated that the feds didn't pursue him, not because it was going to undermine what's the operative line that's getting tossed around in the gun rights sphere. The case could open up a huge loophole in federal law, said the unnamed ATF source. It could lead to an explosion in the number of AR-15s out on the street, is what they're trying to say, is they want to kind of go after him for this manufacturing of 80% lowers into operative rifles. But I really read that not as, oh, the law's on such shaky ground that we can't really put it under too much legal scrutiny because it might just completely collapse on us like a house of cards, or the any sort of trying to prosecute us for the crime that we think we see would be overstepping how the law is written. And I mean, again, he's definitely exploiting some loopholes, but at the same time, these quote unquote loopholes are happening all the time. It's one of those, like, everyone's making an AR-15, you know, Smith & Wesson, Springfield Armory, Colt, all that. They didn't design it. That's Eugene Stoner who did that. And they're technically working off his stuff. And even if they're modifying it slightly, they're still standing on the shoulders of Gene Stoner. So firearm laws are goofy, but you got to draw a line somewhere.
Okay, so we've determined that the first line, he sold illegal AR-15s, is factually incorrect, because AR-15s are not illegal, even in California.
Yeah, unless this journalist is a complete and utter hack, and they've buried the fact that he was doing something straight up completely and utterly illegal in the shop.
In which case, it should read, he sold AR-15s illegally. Mm. Because grammar matters.
Yeah.
The rifles are not illegal. What he did may have been illegal, in which case he sold them illegally, but AR-15s are not illegal, even in California.
Yep.
Yet. So the next part. Feds agreed to let him go free to avoid hunting gun control efforts. And this is something that I've read it several times. I don't get it. So here's my understanding. We all know, hopefully we all know, that the lower receiver of an AR-15 is considered the legal definition of the gun. And so a felon could acquire an upper and a lower parts kit and a stock and all that other stuff, and that's fine. And then, okay, an 80% lower is not a firearm. Okay, true. But it was my understanding that if a felon takes an 80% lower and turns it into a 100% lower, that is an actual gun. Mm-hmm. And therefore, because they are a prohibited person, that is the moment they have broken the law. Mm-hmm. And so I don't understand how they needed to let him go to avoid hurting gun control efforts. And then there's this whole smokescreen, it sounds like, where they're talking about how the AR-15 is different from other guns because it has an upper and a lower receiver. And the technical definition of a receiver involves things like a bolt carrier and a way for the barrel to attach. And the lower receiver of an AR-15 doesn't have that. So somehow, magically, it's not a receiver, and that's the can of worms they don't want to open, and I don't understand.
I think that is just holy crap.
I mean, it might just be the article writer doesn't understand. It might also be that they are just spewing out a lot of flares and chaff in order to confuse and scare people, mm-hmm. because I'm not seeing how the one goes together. And so, okay, what does this have to do with hurting gun control efforts? What?
Yeah. Again, AR-15 is not unique. If you have a Glock receiver, the part of a Glock that is a firearm, it's practically nothing. It's just a chunk of plastic, and it doesn't have the barrel. It doesn't have that. It's not any of the metal parts. It's not any of the pressure containing parts. That's actually one of the big differences between United States and British firearms law is British register the pressure containing vessel. So the barrel of your gun is actually the firearm, which is very, very interesting, because one of the reasons why we can have these build parties and things like that is because the receiver is actually a fairly easy part to make and is not as big a deal as, say, the rifled barrel.
Yeah, and so looking at this article, it makes it sound like the AR-15 is this magically dangerous weapon because it's got an upper and lower receiver. And as you just pointed out, the same definition applies to every semi-automatic pistol ever. Mm-hmm. Anything with a moving slide, and I could be wrong.
I think you might be slightly wrong, because I believe, I know the Browning Buckmark is the upper receiver of the Browning Buckmark is actually the serialized part on that. So the actual grip frame portion of that gun is actually not the serialized part. It's one of those. It's super arbitrary. We both own Mosins. I mean, essentially, the barrel trunnion's the receiver on that gun.
Well, I actually thought you were going to bring up the Madaba auto revolver. It's a revolver and it's semi-automatic. Because you're such a handgun nerd.
Yeah, but I think the serialized part on that is pretty much the grip frame.
and so it's just I read this and it's like, why are you making this such a big deal? And I honestly thought I was missing something important, because it's this whole, oh my God, we have to let this guy go or else it's going to destroy gun control and this is horrible, and there's this judge's ruling, and it's just, I'm looking at it and going, what is the hysteria here? Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, the moment they drilled that final hole or milled out the cavity or whatever, that's when they broke the law. There you go. What's the drama?
Yep, exactly.
And I think the drama might be California and CNN.
This is the same nonsense that we get for, we can't have constitutional carry because we need that gatekeeper to keep people from illegally carrying firearms. And it's one of those bad people are illegally carrying firearms right now everywhere in the whole world, not just the United States. There's people illegally carrying firearms in South Africa, in England, in Japan. It's happening everywhere, and they don't care that they don't have a permit. The difference is that if you are a prohibited person, however your law may define you at that, the moment they catch you, then they put you in jail. Actually, kind of like one of Beto's secondary remarks for his like banning all the AR-15s. Well, I'm not going to go door to door, but if you ever shoot or handle that AR-15, well, then we'll come after you and get you. If we ever catch you with the AR-15 out in public, which, I mean, to be fair, that's a pretty good little bit of infringement right there, because it's essentially saying you cannot train or practice in any sort of open way with this firearm, because that's when they're going to come and get you. So, yeah, this is just, I mean, again, states, again, these, anytime these controls are put in, they exclusively target the law abiding. This doesn't affect bad guys or criminals in any way, shape, or form. And no matter how much they him and haw, it's just not true. And so, yeah. And I mean, another reason, why do you guys oppose gun control laws so much? Because foolishness like this.
All right. So let's stop talking about the stupidity that is California gun laws and ATF rulings and talk about something that actually makes sense. And this is really cool because I am a prepper and I understand that Egghead is here to continue a very interesting series. So what have you got for me, Weird?
Yeah, back in episode 70, the Egghead talked about some popular water purification methods. And he now has a follow-up segment with even more details on how to make sourced water safer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the General Purpose Egghead segment. At the conclusion of the last segment, I promised a review of various different water filters to talk about their advantages and disadvantages. As Aaron mentioned, there was a recent blue-collar prepping blog post about that very topic that covered it extremely well. They linked to a independent testing of a bunch of different filters that I had never even heard of, and I actually learned a lot from it. So I'd recommend taking a look at that. That covered it better than I could in any 10-minute segment and is very well researched. I'll add a link in the show notes. I will say just two things. One is that it seemed from the list that really long-lasting filters that don't wear out quickly, that remove viruses, tend to have a very slow flow rate. Lifestraw makes one. Sawyer used to make one. They're basically drip filters, and they'll remove bacteria, protozoa, as well as viruses. The more popular ones that are a little more practical have a faster flow rate and are very easy to use. Those do not remove viruses, but remove everything else. Aaron actually made a post as well about why she uses the Sawyer Mini, which is also my favorite of these filters, and describes why viruses aren't a terribly common contaminant. So I'd say take a look at that. I did want to make one clarification of the last segment. I referred to solar distillation. I misspoke a little bit. I've heard it referred to as solar distillation. This is actually solar disinfection is the method I was talking about. It's an interesting method of purifying water where you take PET plastic bottles, specifically that type of plastic. You fill them with water and you leave them in direct sunlight for at least 6 hours. And UV light and the heat will kill anything in the water and make it safe to drink, at least as far as bacteria, protozoa, and viruses are concerned. Any chemicals in the water will still be there, the same as with most filters that don't use some kind of chemical carbon filter that wears out quickly. There are a couple caveats with this. One is that you do need to use PET plastic bottles. They're very common, and you can recognize them because they have the little recyclable symbol with the one in the middle. That indicates the type of plastic is PET. They also have to be clear and in good condition, and the water can't be cloudy. You're relying on the sunlight to penetrate into the water and kill the microorganisms with UV radiation. That's also why you need to use PET plastic instead of glass or another kind of plastic, because certain kinds of plastics and glass will block most UV radiation. So anything that makes it so that the light can't get all the way into the middle of your water to be purified without being impeded in any way is going to cause problems for you. There's a handy test. They call it the newspaper test. If you take your 2-liter soda bottle and fill it full of the water and set it on top of a newspaper, if you can't look through the top of the water bottle and read the newspaper beneath, it's probably too cloudy to use solar disinfection. Another thing to be aware of is most of the information I've found on it indicates that heat is a important part of the process, as well as the UV light. In my research, I found a paper that I will link to in the show notes where they tested solar disinfection at slightly cooler temperatures, and it seemed like anything above 55 degrees it would still work. Much below that, though, I'm not sure how well it would work. I don't think this is a method of purification that you should rely on, but since all it requires is used plastic bottles, it's a handy trick to have in your arsenal. So that covers everything that I really meant to cover in my last segment, but since then I've come across a new product that I thought I'd share with you guys. I actually ordered it since then. It has arrived. I haven't had a chance to test it out, but it comes with a pretty good pedigree. It was developed by Procter & Gamble in conjunction with the CDC, and it's used in a lot of non-governmental organizations providing clean drinking water in undeveloped parts of the world. It's fairly inexpensive. It removes all living organisms as contaminants and also removes a lot of chemicals and even heavy metals like lead or arsenic. Honestly, considering all the good things I'm reading about it, it's kind of amazing I haven't heard of it before. This product is the Procter & Gamble Purifier of Water. Clearly, all of their money went into R&D and not into advertising or creative naming. In principle, it's really quite simple. It's a small packet of powder, and you cut the packet open and dissolve it in 2.5 gallons of water. To dissolve it, you will have to stir very, very thoroughly. They say about 5 minutes of continuous stirring to dissolve it and agitate it sufficiently. Then you just wait a half an hour and then run it through a very simple cloth filter like a t-shirt and drink it. So how does this thing work? The packet contains 2 powdered chemicals that are commonly used in water treatment plants. One of them is calcium hypochlorite, which is basically pool shock, and the other one is ferric sulfate. The calcium hypochlorite, when it dissolves in the water, releases chlorine, which kills all the microorganisms and little squirmy bits in your water. The other chemical, ferric sulfate, is what they call a flocculant, and that is my new favorite word. A flocculant flocculates, and by which I mean it generates flock. So it causes any dissolved solids or certain chemicals to clump up together around that dissolved material, the ferric sulfate. And as they clump out, they become heavier and settle to the bottom. It just kind of causes all of the nasties to just precipitate out of your solution and gather in the bottom like sludge. That sludge at the bottom is referred to as flock, and it is spelled F-L-O-C. And then you can very easily filter that out with just a t-shirt or a piece of cloth. And the crazy thing is, it doesn't just work on like dirt or something that's dissolved in your water. It'll remove a lot of chemicals. It'll remove DDT, or pesticides. It'll remove lead, arsenic, chromium, all sorts of crazy stuff. I'll be linking to a document that was from the University of Michigan, and they did some testing on it, and it's kind of impressive the amount of stuff that it'll remove. There are a couple of things that it doesn't remove that they specifically call out. It doesn't work on salty water, so you're not going to purify seawater with this. And it doesn't work on fluoride or nitrate. Fluoride is a common water additive that it's a disinfectant. If you have a lot of fluoride, I suppose it could be a problem, but small amounts of fluoride in drinking water are not a problem at all. It's actually put in your water a lot of the time. Nitrates are fertilizers. A lot of fertilizers have nitrates, so I probably wouldn't want to use this in agricultural runoff or something like that. They also mention low molecular weight organic chemicals. I'm not entirely sure exactly what they mean by that, but they mention certain industrial solvents. So certain types of maybe cleaning chemicals it wouldn't pull out of your water, but I don't think you're going to have it in your water to begin with. The other one is that it does remove heavy metals, but it reduces the percentage of them. It doesn't clean them out completely. So if you have really high concentrations of dissolved heavy metals, it's not going to make the water safe to drink. It also doesn't work in soapy water, so you're not going to be using your dirty dishwater to drink. But all of these are crazy edge cases that are not very common in disaster situations, so it'll pretty much purify anything you need to be worried about. The cost of these packets isn't bad, but they definitely get cheaper in bulk. The actual manufacturing cost of them is something like 35 cents a packet, and that's what they sell it to when they send it to non-governmental organizations in the third world. But a lot of that is funded by folks like you and me, so we're going to pay a higher price. It's still not that bad, though. You can get 12 of these packets, each packet filtering 2.5 gallons, for $20. In terms of dollars per gallons of water purified, that's about 67 cents per gallon. If you really want to get a lot of it, you can get a case of 240 packets for $100. That'll filter 600 gallons of water, and you're going to be paying about 17 cents per gallon at that point. That is a lot, though, and this stuff does have a shelf life of 3 years, so it will eventually go bad. If you and a couple of buddies want to split a giant case, that seems like a pretty good deal. The option I went with is a third option. There's a product called the Day One Water Bag that is designed to work with these purifier of water packets. It's basically a giant camelback. It's a 2.5 gallon camelback, and the top of it closes up like those dry bags where there's a buckle on each end and you just roll it over a couple of times and buckle it, and it forms a waterproof seal. It's a pretty simple little backpack. It's not really designed to transport water. It's designed to be used to filter the water. So what you do is you fill this up in the river, you throw the packet in, and you grab the handles on the side that they build in for you, and you just kind of twist it, and kind of shake it for about 5 minutes. And then all the muck settles out to the bottom. And the feed point for the little hose that you can drink your water out of is about 6 to 8 inches above the bottom. So at this point, you don't even have to filter it. All the nasty stuff is below where you're drinking from. So you just hang it up on a tree, shake it around for 5 minutes, wait a half an hour, and then you have 2.5 gallons of water that you could just walk over there and pour out. That's about $80, and it comes with 60 packets. So it's cheaper than buying just 60 packets, which is a little bit crazy. It is a little bit hard to find, though. It's out of stock at the store that sells the packets, which is Day One Response. A couple of third-party vendors sell it as well. The one I bought from is now out of stock as well. So if you can find one, I'd pick up one of those. Otherwise, you can just get the packets and run them in a 5-gallon bucket. That works just fine. The next time I get my lazy ass out in the woods to go camping, I'll bring it with me, and if I have the opportunity, I will test it out and report back and let you know how it works for me. That's it for this week, guys. Stay safe and be smart.
So I want to thank Egghead for promoting two of our articles, the one written by Chaplain Tim, who, by the way, is... Well, he's retired now, but he was an actual chemist, water scientist. He worked for water purification plants in the cities, so he knows his stuff. And he posted about these water filter reviews. And I also wanted to thank him for plugging the article about the Sawyer and why I love it, even though it didn't score incredibly high. It scored well enough, but it wasn't the, oh my God, this is awesome. But there are two things that I want to point out. First of all, there's another article by Chaplain Tim very recently where he talks about the different types of plastics that are used for food, for water, and what they're good for, what they aren't. And so PET plastic, polyethyl something or other. I should have looked that up, but I don't have it with me. He goes on and explains its properties and what it's good for and what it's not good for. And he talks about the other properties of the different food-grade plastics as well. I think that's really cool. And next he's going to talk about metals, because there has been concern about drinking from aluminum and how aluminum it supposedly leaches out into the water and can poison you and things like that. I have some issues with that because aluminum oxidizes into basically a thin layer of sapphire. So unless the layer of oxide is broken, I think you're okay. But I'm not a chemist. The other thing that I want to talk about is something that I mentioned way, way back in the early days of Gunblog Variety Cast, like within the first 10 episodes. And there is a procedure called water pasteurization. And it's a good way to render water drinkable by killing the microbes. It doesn't sanitize it, but it requires much less fuel because you only have to bring water up to 149 degrees Fahrenheit to pasteurize it as opposed to 212 degrees. And so that's a big savings of time and energy. You don't have to get as much firewood. You don't have to babysit it as much. And I think that's a really cool technique that not a lot of people know about. And just read the article. There's a really cool piece of kit that you can get for like under $10, and it weighs practically nothing at all. And it's how you can tell that water's been pasteurized, because, well, when you boil the water, you see that it's boiling. It's obvious. How do you know when it's reached the pasteurization point? Well, you get the water pasteurization indicator, and it's this stupidly simple bit of low tech that it'll tell you that there's a wax, and the wax melts at the pasteurization point. And when it flows from the top to the bottom, ta-da, the water is pasteurized and it's safe to drink. And I think that's really cool. And who knows, maybe Egghead will go into greater detail of how this works.
Plus, also, would the water pasteurization, since you're not boiling it, wouldn't you also, I think it might be minimal, but wouldn't you retain more of the water that you're sourcing? Since, obviously, if you're going to be scrounging water in a prepper type situation, I would assume that you're looking to keep as much of it as you can and not boil a bunch of it off.
Well, that's true. I don't know how much is lost to evaporation as part of the boiling process, but if you're in a situation where every little bit helps, yeah, it'll do that.
It is also good that Egghead did clarify that whole bit on sanitizing the water with sunlight.
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah, that clears up our questions.
David's series on bullet making is going on hiatus for a time, so in this week's segment of Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, he wraps things up by describing such arcane features as armory molds, gas checks, and vent lines. If that was all Greek to you, take a listen to learn what they are.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. This will be my last segment on bullet casting for a while, so I'd like to wrap up for now with the history of bullet molds. Some of the earliest firearm accessories made were bullet molds. In the dawn of firearms development, reloading tools were generally provided with every new pistol or rifle. Since all barrels were bored by hand, having a bullet mold properly sized to your firearm was essential. Colt Firearms made molds both round ball and conical bullets for their cap and ball revolvers. Starting around 1870, Remington Arms sold bullet molds made by the Bridgeport Gun Implement Company. After introducing their line of centerfire cartridge revolvers, Smith & Wesson sold reloading kits that contained a bullet mold until about 1912. Early bullet molds were cast in one piece, including the handles. They were made out of iron or brass. Bullet molds made out of stone, wood, and even bone have been found. Wooden handles were added to molds made by Winchester in 1890. This must have been a great relief for bullet casters everywhere. Those metal-handled molds got hot quickly. Modern molds are made primarily of steel, brass, or aluminum. At first, molds came in two basic types, single or double cavity with permanently attached handles, and what were called armory molds. These were used for casting a large number of projectiles in each batch. As the name implies, they were used by armories to make bullets in bulk. Armory molds might have as few as 6 cavities or as many as 24. Interchangeable single-cavity mold blocks for use with removable handles were introduced by the Ideal Lyman Company in 1927. However, exchangeable double-cavity molds didn't appear until after World War II. Hollow base and hollow point bullet molds use removable pins to form the cavities. This does add a couple more steps to the casting process, but allows the caster to produce a wider variety of bullets, such as hollow base Meunier bullets. It's usually not too difficult to determine approximately when a mold was made, as long as you have certain details, such as removable handles or fixed, gas check or not, caliber introduction date, vented or not, manufacture, as well as a variety of other characteristics. Just to review these a little bit, following Ideal's lead, pretty much every mold manufacturer went to removable handles by the early 1930s. Gas checks are small copper or aluminum caps that fit on the base of the bullet to prevent gas cutting and allow for loading to higher pressure and greater velocity. Gas checks were originally patented in 1907, but it wasn't until a couple of years later that Ideal started producing molds with a rebated base for the gas check. The early type of gas check was designed to fall off after the bullet left the barrel. It wasn't until the mid-1970s that Hornady came up with the current crimp-on gas check design. Mold manufacturers added gas check versions for different calibers at different times. This information isn't always easy to find unless you have access to a good variety of old catalogs. Obviously, a mold for a specific caliber wouldn't be made until that caliber became sufficiently popular. On the other hand, molds will be dropped from a catalog once a particular caliber is no longer in sufficient demand. Vent lines in molds are almost hair-fine grooves on the internal faces of a mold that allow air to escape as the mold is being filled. This improves fill-out and reduces the likelihood of voids in bullets produced. Vent lines began to be added to bullet molds starting in the late 1940s, but didn't become common practice until the 1960s. Throughout the history of bullet molds, manufacturers have come and gone, been bought, sold, merged, and changed names. Knowing when those events happen can help date a particular mold. There have been quite a few mold manufacturers over the years. Some have been around for the long haul, and others were merely a flash in the pan. In addition to Colt, Remington, and Smith & Wesson, as I mentioned earlier, some of the names you might see are Sharps, Marlin, who had John Browning design a bullet mold and loading tool for them, Belding and Mull, who were the primary makers of the molds Elmer Keith designed, Hensley and Gibbs, Kramer Bullet Mold Company, Bond Manufacturing Company, later Modern Bond, Ideal, Lyman, and many more. As I've mentioned in previous segments, the web book by Glenn Frexel and Robert Applegate, From Ingot to Target, A Cast Bullet Guide for Handgunners, is an excellent reference whether you're interested in collecting molds, bullet casting, or simply the science and techniques for education purposes. Some vintage mold catalogs are available online or can be found on auction sites. These can be quite useful in helping to identify bullet molds. That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
I love the fact that he was going through the history of that. I love hearing how technology develops, because I mean, when you look at, especially if you click on some of the links that he's got, like these, some of these bullets are really complicated as far as how they're made and how they function. And he talked about the Meunier balls, which was just a really, really neat way of how to make a muzzle loading bullet that worked in a rifled firearm, because it was the first rifles, when you had to hammer that bullet all the way down the rifling so that it would stay engaged with the rifling, it just took forever to load them. It's interesting to see these developments and how they're going on. And I actually was not aware that the original gas checks were discarded.
Yeah, I had never heard of gas checks before, and I actually had to listen to that segment twice to fully understand it. Maybe I wasn't paying attention, but okay, so gas checks are in a bullet, and what? Why are they falling off? Yeah, I had to go back and get that again, because it wasn't clear to me. I couldn't fully envision it.
Yeah, essentially, it's like a little copper base that you put on the bullet, and essentially, you see it with people that are using lead bullets. Like, you see it a lot with, like, long-distance 45-70 shooters.
It's kind of like a shot cup, but not exactly.
Yes. Well, that's what I assume the discarding ones were. The modern mm-hmm. ones are swaged right onto the base of the bullet. So the bullet right. is essentially a unjacketed lead bullet, but the very, very rear of the bullet is jacketed, essentially. And so there's that little bit of copper. I don't know if it acts as a driving band and engages the rifling. I think it may, but it certainly prevents the hot powder from that heavy powder charge. Because again, these are people that are really looking to push the limits of black powder or use a gun that was designed for black powder into smokeless. So if you're shooting a smokeless 45-70 and you're loading it hot, you don't want that pressure to be so great that it's starting to erode the base of the bullet.
You used a term I've never heard before, driving band.
Yes, that's so for something like the best example that I know of is the 40 millimeter grenades used by our troops is the 40 millimeter grenade launchers we got. I mean, you hang them on the end of an M4, and M4 is a pretty light gun. And so you're not putting a heavy steel barrel like if you were imagining making like a 40 millimeter rifle, but they are rifled. And essentially what that is there's a little collar around the middle of the 40 millimeter round. I don't know if it's below or above the crimp, but essentially it's made of like usually brass, some soft metal. And the whole point is that is what forms the seal. Very much actually also like a shot cup on a shotgun, where the shot cup is there. Cause if you just dumped your shot down on top of your powder charge, it would just blow the gas would just blow past the shots and it would go through. And if you made the 40 millimeter round oversized enough that it had to swage into the rifling so to engage it without the gas blowing by, you would need to make the barrel heavy enough. And I think actually the like the M203s, I think that's an aluminum barrel. Like it's super duper light. And it does that by means of having a driving band. Is it's just enough metal to seal and just enough metal to engage with the rifling, but not enough to have excess pressure that would cause the barrel to bulge.
Wow. I learned something. I learned several somethings.
There's also some talk about the possibility for, so we were just talking about the 80% lowers and talking about neener, 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 your gun laws are kind of useless with stuff like the 3D printed guns. In theory, you could take a lead bullet and put a soft driving band on that lead bullet to act as a seal. You might even be able to 3D print a driving band so that it would have enough to seal the bore and act as engage the rifling, but would put less stress on the plastic parts because normally we make barrels out of steel.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some other things we learned. One of our favorite guests has returned for an encore presentation. Weird, we've got Logan Mitesh back, and what's he talking about this time?
Last time we talked to Logan on the show, we were talking about the amazing career of John Pedersen. I invited Logan back to talk about another firearms designer who made some great guns that we have all heard about. But we've heard about his guns, but not his name, which we'll just talk about that in the interview. Okay, joining the show once again is firearms historian and proprietor at High Caliber History, Logan Mitesh. How you doing, Logan?
I'm doing great. How are you?
And I wanted to have you on. Last time we talked about John Pedersen, who is a guy that has a prolific firearms designing career, but is not someone that's on the tip of the tongue of people as, say, Eugene Stoner or John Browning. This person who actually had... Well, Pedersen had very close ties with John Browning. This guy also had very close ties to John Browning, but you don't hear about him very much. As a matter of fact, you hear about him so infrequently, I have no idea how to pronounce his name.
Yeah, you know, you're in good company there because I don't know exactly how to pronounce his name either. I've heard it a few different ways. Probably the more correct way would be Dieudonné Saïve. But I've also heard it, I guess you can call it Americanized, of just Dieudonné Saïve. But in an effort to avoid butchering his name repeatedly for the duration of the segment here, I think we're just going to refer to him as DS or Mr. DS, because really, quite frankly, we're going to have a lot of acronyms in this talk, you know, including FAL and NATO and FN and M2 and GP and ACP. I mean, there's going to be a lot of acronyms. So I think he'll be right at home with just DS.
Yeah. So who was this Belgian man?
So this man, Mr. DS, he comes to us May 23rd, 1888, and he is a prolific arms designer. You know, as you and I have talked, we've said that John Pedersen was kind of John Browning 2.0, and Mr. DS is kind of John Browning 2.0.1, if you will, because they were very well linked together in a lot of the stuff they did. But he was also a prolific arms designer on his own. And of course, what most people know him for is the FAL, or the Fusil Automatique de Guerre, which again, we'll just call it the FAL because I'll continue to butcher it, which has become known as the right arm of the free world. And rightly so, because that gun has been used everywhere and is used everywhere. And that is his main claim to fame. But he did a lot of other work. He spent the majority of his career at FN. He joined them shortly after high school and worked there all the way through retirement in, I believe, 1954. So he had a very long career with FN. But that's not to say that he didn't do work elsewhere. During World War I, when Belgium was invaded, he went to the UK and did some work for the Vickers Company. In 1928, he went to Yugoslavia and helped set up the state arsenal in a town that starts with a K that I won't even begin to try to pronounce. And he also spent some time in the UK again, this time during World War II, working with Enfield. And so he's got a lot of irons in the fire throughout his career, despite the fact that the majority of it was spent at FN.
So what are some of the designs that he, do you have some earlier work that he did before his major breakthroughs came through?
The easiest thing is, like we said, you know, he went to FN shortly after high school. And then, of course, I mentioned with the World War I era, he was in the UK working for Vickers. But then when he comes back to FN in the early 1920s, that's where things really start to pick up for him, and his association with Browning really takes off. In 1921, France approaches FN to design a semi-auto pistol with a 15-round capacity. And at this time, John Browning is FN's chief designer, and he is uninterested in working on something like that. He is totally happy with his single-stack magazines. You know, the Colt 1911 is charging head-on and doing very well by 1921. And, you know, by God, that gun's good enough with a single stack. Your gun in France should be good enough with a single stack. So he's really not interested. But it's Mr. DS who decides, well, I think I'd like to take on that double stack challenge, which sounds like it should be from a fast food commercial. But he decides to base his initial magazine design off of the FN Model 1903, which is not the same as the Colt 1903, which is also another Browning design. This one's in 9x20mm, and it's with that magazine that Browning finally, he sees the light bulb and he realizes that, okay, maybe it's time we should start working with the French to design this new pistol. So they come up with a couple different options, one of which is a lock breech option designed using this new magazine. But this is where Mr. DS really takes it over for Browning, because the patent isn't issued on this particular design until February of 1927, which is a few months after Browning passed away. So he is really kind of off and running with this design. The result of this gun is the 13-round, again, Americanizing the pronunciation, the Grand Redemptment. And it's a 13-round pistol. It uses some of the patent designs that Browning had created for the 1911. Of course, being the legal-minded man he was, he waited until Colt's patents had expired on there to not get into any trouble. And he further refines that pistol. And then he kind of steps away. There's some things going on in the interim years. In 1928, he goes to Yugoslavia and he sets up a state arsenal there. In 1929, he comes back to Belgium and he oversees the manufacture of a commercial version of yet another John Browning design, the BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle. By 1930, he ends up occupying what was Browning's position there. He's now their chief weapons designer, trying to fill some really big shoes. Again, continuing to improve on more of Browning's designs, including the M1919 M2 in 1932, increasing the rate of fire on that gun. And by 1938, he has tinkered with it even more, and he's managed to get the rate of fire up to 1,500 rounds per minute. Going back to 1931, what we know is the FN Baby Browning, despite having Browning's name in it, it's not Browning's gun. Browning has passed by this time, and so the FN Baby Browning is actually a design by Mr. DS. Very popular 25 ACP caliber gun, more than 500,000 of them made, primarily between 1931 and 1979. They go on to be made by a few other countries or a few other companies as well, like MAB between 79 and 83. And I think there's even one U.S. company still making them today. So there's a lot going on in his world. He is an incredibly busy designer, working on a variety of different things. But like all good inventors, you know, certain stuff, the cream rises to the top. And so by 1934, the French term grand puissance, meaning high power, was first applied to the design for what becomes the French GP35 self-loading pistol, that then goes on to be known as the FM Browning High Power. And of course, the iconic place in history that that gun has is that it's the first 9x19 millimeter handgun using a true staggered column double stack magazine.
Now, one thing to stop you real quick on it, just because my handgun radio geek is diving in, and one of the things that I'm very, very fascinated on is things that lead up to what are pretty much the modern standards. And of course, you know, you pick up a Glock or you pick up any of these like brand new striker fired pistols, because everyone's making one now, almost all of them have what is called the Browning linkless system. Was that right? Was that an actual Browning invention, or is that another one that DS just allowed Browning to take the credit for?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't have an answer to that. I'm not sure, but that is a great question. Perhaps someone listening to this will know the answer and chime in comment somewhere and let us know. So, the high power design is now in full swing. It's what we know today as the high power. It has been refined to that design, and so you would think that now that's essentially what the French said they wanted to some extent back in 1921, now that the design is really raring to go and in its final production form, they would adopt the gun, right?
That seems natural, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because it seems natural and logical, we're going to do the opposite. So instead, they adopt what becomes known as the M1935. And that is chambered in 7.65 long, which is a derivative. And here's another tie-in to our previous conversation. It's a derivative of the cartridge that the Pedersen device fired during World War I era.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's all linked together. And this M1935 is an interesting design because the Swiss actually really like the design, and they end up licensing it, and it becomes the basis of their P210 pistol. So moving on from there, FN markets this new gun as the Browning High Power, probably because the Dieudonné-Saïve High Power is just too much to fit on a slide. But so they offer it to the world, and in 1940, by that point, they've sold more than 56,000 of them, most of which go to the Belgian military. Of course, also by 1940, Germany has started their invasion route for the past year, moving through Europe. And in May of 1940, they occupy Belgium, and they have taken over FN's production plant there in Liège. And so they are making a version of the high power at the FN plant there under their designation, the Pistol 640B. But, okay, now we've got Belgium occupied by Germany. We know that Mr. DS doesn't like to be in Belgium when his country has been invaded, given the fact that he went to the UK to work for Vickers during World War I. So where is he during World War II? He's back in the UK, but this time he's working for Enfield. And by 1944, they are busy making copies of his P-35 designated pistol, and they call it the number 2 Mark 1. Other high powers that are being made in Toronto and Canada, because again, that's still a British held place, they are making them by John Inglis and Company, and they've got two different variants that they make there. There's one with fixed sights that, you know, you see on high power designs all over the place, and then you see a design that is really, really sought after by collectors because it's got a tangent sight. And that pistol is also cut for a detachable shoulder stock. And those guns are the cream of the crop in the collector world. When you get guys that really love high powers, they are really looking for those tangent sights. Now, a lot of those guns were sent to China, but the guns that didn't go to China ended up with the Canadian Army, and it was designated the number 1 Mark 1. After World War II, the high power design continues to march on, and it is without a shadow of a doubt the most iconic 1911-esque design pistols out there. And it's really, really something that Mr. DS doesn't get the credit that he deserves for it, because even though it bears Browning's name, it's not Browning's gun. I mean, sure, he laid the groundwork for the design, but, you know, if the guy's dead for the entire production of the gun, it's not really his. And Mr. DS just gets slighted on that. I mean, it became the standard issue pistol for more than 90 countries throughout the world. I mean, that is a hell of an accomplishment. And, you know, as we said at the beginning, he's so unknown, we don't even really know how to pronounce his name. And that's an absolute shame.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. We haven't even gotten into the rifles that we mentioned earlier, but I think we're running a little long on time, so I'll have to have you back next week.
All righty. Well, thanks for having me, and I'm looking forward to being back.
Yeah. Again, that's Logan Benesch from High Caliber History.
So once again, you guys are talking about someone I have never heard of, and I'm actually a little bit ashamed to call myself a gunny for not having heard of the man who created the Browning High Power.
I know. I mean, again, that was when I called Logan up to start the interview, and we usually have a little bit of banter. We just talk a little bit, and I'm adjusting the levels on the recorder and making sure everything's working just fine, and we're catching up. We're being pals. And I'm like, all right, Logan, how the hell does this guy say his name? And he's like, oh, I was going to ask you. Like, it's just one of those, like, we're guessing. I like to mumble it whenever I say his name so that it just sounds like I'm just not articulate as opposed to not knowing how to say his name. But yeah, like, I've heard, you know, people suspect, but it's not as simple as, I mean, even John Garand, it's a little bit of a question. There is some articles and some discussion. There's some information out there of it, though. I found a video of the actual Springfield Armory introducing John Garand and talking about his M1 rifle. And they said John Garand, as opposed to John Garand, which is allegedly how he pronounced his name. But I couldn't actually find a video on YouTube of the designer of the M1 rifle saying his own name in his lovely French Canadian accent.
Wait, so if he's French-Canadian, his name might have been Garand.
Very well might have been. Very well might have been. But of course, also French-Canadian, not Parisian French. So, man, the Québécois, they like to chew on their French before they spit it out. Oh, my grandmother was French-Canadian, and oh boy, yeah, it is not the stuff that you hear in the Parisian French. Yeah, this guy, I think it's just his big issue is that he was in the shadow of John Browning and at the same time super duper humble. Again, as far as I know, he pretty much designed the Browning high power. Like, it's pretty much his gun. And yet he turned around and pretty much and called it the Browning. He just said, yeah, this is John Browning's gun. Also, we will be talking about it next week. He's also the designer of the FNFAL, one of my favorite rifles.
The FNFAL.
Hilariously, as far as I know, there's no proper way to pronounce that. It's not one of those things of the... If you swing by the Steyr booth and you start talking about the AUG, they're like, no, it's the AUG. don't pronounce it AUG. But it seems like it's about 50-50 of people that pronounce it FAL or FAL.
I was expecting nine. It was pronounced AUG.
I don't know if I've ever bumped into. No, I have bumped into a few people in the Steyr booth that are actually from Austria, but as a general rule, most of the staff is the American staff.
My very first NRA, I dropped by the Tavor booth and I was wearing my T-shirt with Princess Luna, dual wielding Tavors, mm-hmm. And there was one gentleman working the booth. I don't remember his name, but he was very obviously Israeli. He had that accent. And he thought my shirt was one of the coolest things he'd ever seen, and he took a picture of it.
I have one of those shirts, because it is one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And all the little girls in my life who love My Little Pony love the shirt as well. And they just have no questions of the, Daddy, what's a bullpup? Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus contents like our absolutely hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com, and hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can get more from me at lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com, pingpistols.org, and blazingsword.org.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
So he edits the sound, which means he's really my sound guy. And I'm just too pretty to come up with an outro right now. I'm just your pretty, pretty co-host. Our duties on this podcast are assorted, and they're weighted very heavily on him. And so is our podcast. Good night, everyone.
Good night.